I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, I talk with my colleague Steve Jackson about tonight's, Wednesday night's, Spokane Public Radio Forum on homelessness. As in many American cities, homelessness has become a much more visible problem in Spokane. The city conducted its annual required point-in-time census of homeless people in January. The results are out soon. The city and private companies are spending more money to provide services to those people. All of those things will be subjects of this program. This year, we're doing something slightly different with the forum. Usually, we conduct a two-hour discussion with one panel of experts and a live audience in the Spokane City Hall Council Chambers. This year, because of the number of people involved in addressing homelessness, Steve has created two panels so that we can bring more people into the conversation. He's here with us now to talk about with whom we'll be talking with. So let's start with your first hour.
Yeah, and that's an interesting point because literally we have four panelists in each hour. And we probably really, because there's so many organizations involved in this homelessness issue that we really, I almost felt like we didn't have enough people. We probably could have had 12 and still done a good job, but we just had, you know, too many people and then the time constraints of a two-hour forum. So it's set up like it has been in the past in that, just to clarify, I'll be asking the panelists questions for the first part of each hour, but it will be open to the whoever participates and comes down to the forum to ask questions as well, because we know the audience members often have even better questions than we can come up with. But generally, to describe what we have going on, Doug, the first panel, we have Tim Sigler from the city of Spokane, who's works on the homelessness issue. Kay Morano, who is a person that finds housing options for folks in the city, low-income housing folks. Edie Rice Sauer, also a similar type job description. She's with the group Transitions, who has some housing, either transitional housing for people that's kind of temporary for women and families, but also they have these cottages that we did a story on in the community that's actually permanent housing for some folks. And then we've got Dr. Bob Lutz from the health district. So we're going to ask him questions about just, you know, issues related to health and the health district and how they may get involved in this process. So, I mean, just to give you an overview, I think when you mentioned the homeless count, we're going to ask Tim Sigler if he can give us any indications how that's going. I think officially they're not going to release that, like you said, for another week or so. But we can at least get an idea of maybe how the trends are going on that. So, because the first thing I want to determine is how big of a problem is it? If you go downtown these days, you are going to see homeless people all around. But I'm posing the question that is it really more of a visible problem or is it a dramatically increasing problem in our community? Hopefully the homeless count numbers will tell us something, and apparently they've modified the actual method in doing this, and they think that it's going to be more accurate this year than it ever has, so it should show some trends. So that's kind of just to determine that. Now, before we get into who some of the other panelists are, I think part of what prompted me to want to pick up this topic was also along the lines of I had seen an Associated Press series of articles last year that looked at some West Coast cities, Seattle and even Los Angeles and so forth, talking about the massive homeless problem there. But it was also, in a way, tied to how successful the economics of a community were. Like, you think Seattle, you think of Microsoft and Amazon and the like. But part of the issue here is really the lack of affordable housing. So before we just go off and talk just about what homeless services are available in Spokane and if we have adequate services for folks, I also want to focus, and especially in the second hour, look at what are the affordable housing options in Spokane. I know Kay Morano has some information on just the overall numbers, like, and this is off the top of my head, but I believe she said like the rental properties in Spokane, there's only a 2% vacancy. So you could see that it's hard to find housing. And I might as well just tell you, in the second panel, I have a guy who's a realtor who works with this Unlock the Door campaign. And what that is not just realtors, but also some nonprofits working on housing issues over in Olympia this session. They've got a whole slew of bills before the legislature to say, let's try to make some affordable housing more available in all our communities. And so it kind of goes down the ladder, even if they're opening up even maybe, you know, full-blown houses for sale, the more houses in our community, the more available properties they'll be in, and especially even for the lowest of the low income, just more housing available because there are just too many people that don't have a place to live that actually have jobs and so forth. I mean, it's easy for us to say, maybe a lot of these people that are in this homeless situation got there and don't want to get out of it, but that's not true for everybody. And obviously every individual homeless person has their own story. So we know, and for example, in Seattle, there's people working full-time jobs in Seattle, 40 hours a week, that are actually living in their cars. I don't know if that's the same situation here in Spokane, but we'll try to get a handle on finding out how many people are out there that maybe just, you know, they're actually working, maybe just part-time, can't find full employment in Spokane, but the housing issue plays a great part of it.
You're going to have a couple of homeless folks who are in the audience who are going to be there to answer questions, as I recall.
Yeah, well, what I hope to do, because we toyed with the idea of putting maybe a homeless spokesman on the panel, and I couldn't quite find anybody that would maybe have worked in that regard initially. So what I fell back on asking some of these folks that deal with the homeless if they knew of any people that could at least tell their story. And so the people I have coming, I could only find two people that I thought, and I screened several, but their stories were compelling. I won't let the cat out of the bag and tell you the whole thing. They're both females. So part of their story is going to be, you know, how was it as a female to be living on the streets for a period? But both of these people that I ended up getting had actually worked in fairly professional, you know, capacities. They weren't like people that had drug problems or anything like that. Initially, they were people that had regular jobs, and one of them fell through the cracks because of medical bills, and we could see this happening to us. The other gal, a relationship that she had with a person ended, and she found herself homeless, but she also had worked as a grant writer and stuff. And both these people, too, I picked because they're fairly articulate and they can get up and tell their story. So at least I have somebody that can come up for a brief period of time and tell kind of a snapshot of how they ended up in these circumstances. And true, they could take some more questions from either the panelists and or the audience. But I felt we at least had to get somebody in there from the homeless community.
So the rest of your second hour, who else do you have on your?
Okay, so then the second hour, it's sort of similar. We have Rob McCann from Catholic Charities who deals, you know, they've been able to create full-blown housing for a lot of the people that I guess Rob kind of told me in an interview that are more like the chronically homeless type folks. Then we have Kate Burke, Spokane City Council person, who I picked her because she's been working on the homeless issue, and she actually has, I think she was calling it initially a homeless bill of rights. She has a different name for it now, which the name's not popping in my head, but she is actually coming up with proposing some legislation of sorts that the city, she wants to approve to help them, you know, specifically like let's make some public restrooms available. Let's actually sanction, this is, you know, her plan, sanction somewhere where folks can actually camp. I mean, because right now we're dealing with people camping in city parks and the like, but I think she has an idea to maybe see if we could come up with a more permanent location, because obviously these shelters are not enough. And Kate's got a bunch of other good ideas on that front too, and we'll hear more specifics from her. Then I felt we couldn't do this without the business community and their concerns, because, you know, there's this downtown area, a lot of these businesses are having to deal with maybe an influx of people around their business that are frankly scaring customers away and the like. And so I have Mark Richard from Downtown Spokane Partnership coming in to talk about, you know, the business's concerns. And then also I mentioned the realtor, Tom Hormel, is a local realtor that's with that Unlock the Door campaign. He's been following the legislation in Olympia and also is an expert at just things to do with affordable housing in town. He's been a realtor, I think, for 20-some years in Spokane, I believe. So
the event is 6:30 to 8:30, Spokane City Hall, down in the council chambers downstairs, handicapped access available. Steve Jackson is the host of Wednesday evening's Confronting Homelessness discussion at Spokane City Hall. We'll tape the program and air it several times over the next couple of weeks. Next Tuesday and Thursday at 6 p.m. on both SPR stations, we'll split the forum into one-hour blocks and supplement with an hour of live discussions with new panelists in our studio. More on that in the coming days. Many students attending American colleges and universities are chronically hungry. NPR reported on that in January, citing a government report that looked at 31 students and estimating that a third of college students regularly don't get enough to eat. Those numbers are similar to the situation at Eastern Washington University, where reporter Jeremy Burnham is a student journalist.
At Eastern Washington University, students are walking to their 10 o'clock class the day before finals begin. But for some of them, finals may not be the only thing weighing on their minds. Many of these students are hungry. Food insecurity is defined by the USDA as an economic and social condition of limited access to food. And according to a 2016 health and wellness survey conducted at EWU, 36% of Eastern students are food insecure. This is about double the average of American households that are food insecure.
We really recognized food insecurity for our students as a serious issue.
That's Mary Cullinan, the president of EWU. She told me people are often surprised that students are hungry because the stereotype college student comes from a wealthy, upper-class family.
I think it's an age-old prejudice, if you will, that college is somehow for the elite. Many people still miss the point that a community college and certainly a public regional university like Eastern is an access institution.
Many campuses across the country, including EWU, have turned to food pantries to address the issue. At Eastern, there are seven of them in the form of cabinets spread out across campus. Brian Davenport is EWU's Director of Community Engagement. His office helped form the pantries a year ago. He told me unstaffed cabinets were chosen so that they could be open whenever the building they are located in is open. He also said having them unstaffed makes them more inviting to students who feel awkward using the pantries. I'm opening the food pantry cabinet in aisle hall. There are three shelves, and they are all full of food. On the top shelf, here's a bag of hot dog buns, a few bags of dried beans for soup, it looks like, a few cans of chili. Below, I see lots of cans of vegetables. Here's a can of chili. Here's a box of, hamburger helper. There's a few bags of pasta, and below is some pasta sauce. There's actually plenty here to prepare some meals. No, noticeably absent, though, are fresh food items, which limits the amount of healthy options the pantry can offer. Later, I asked Davenport about this.
We're actually going to be opening a centralized location because the primary drawback of the cabinet system is we can't have refrigeration, which means we can't have fresh. And so once we have the central location, we'll be able to have refrigeration so we can have meat, produce, dairy, cheese, eggs, and have those other pieces of a diet that don't come out of a can.
Even when that opens, the cabinets won't close. Food for the pantries come from Second Harvest and from donations from staff and students.
We've done this without any student money or any institutional money. It's all been fundraised, which I'm really delighted about, and we've gotten some good sponsors.
School officials are not the only people addressing the problem. EWU's student body president, Dante Tyler, volunteers with the Washington Student Association, a student lobby organization based in Olympia.
One of the things that fell onto me was food insecurity. I'm like, that's interesting. I never really thought about that.
He has been focusing his efforts on trying to make food stamps more accessible to college students.
One of the main things that I've been pushing for very heavily is a waiver for SNAP benefits. Right now, you need 20 hours of work time to be able to qualify for food stamps or SNAP benefits, but you only can work 19 hours as a college student if you work for the school.
Unlike the food pantries, Tyler's solution would involve using tax dollars. He says it's worth it if it means feeding hungry students.
As a cultural idea that we can't use taxpayer monies to help people with their very minimal needs is very disheartening to me. So, and that's just from me as, politically and just morally, that is very sad that we have that as a culture currently.
I'm Jeremy Burnham, reporting.
To find and subscribe to the Inland Journal podcast, search for Inland Journal in iTunes, NPR One, or Google Play, or find it on the Inland Journal page at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Tell us what you think of the program by sending comments to InlandJournal@KPBX.org or call our listener comment line at 509-232-6904. We appreciate your listening. I'm Doug Nadvornik.